Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday, Thursday, some morning program about science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, John Armstrong, who has a, well, sort of a gray yarn to tell you. Stay tuned. Good morning. Yes, yes, I know. Regular listeners, long-term listeners know I play a lot of music, but no longer. Because, well, for two reasons, actually. Reason number one is that this show, in this time slot, is half an hour less. And in order to facilitate the loss of that time, well, music is one of the things that bites the dust. Reason number two, it's all Matt Kressel's fault. But what isn't? No, it's people were listening 2 weeks ago. Heard Matt Kressel talking about Blade Runner as we talked with Edward Einhorn about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, his off-Broadway production that just finished a very critically successful and sold-out run. But Matt is helping me, actually spearheading, turning what I do into a podcast. Both old and new, the new podcast being, well, this show, and the old being, well, there's 38 years of archives of this show, not to mention when the show was on 5 days a week for a little under a decade. So there's lots and lots and lots of valuable stuff going back to when Margot Adler was the host, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be classic pods, as it were, to go with modern pods. But my and all of this is but one of the things about podcasts is, well, you can't play copyrighted music unless you have paid the rights, and the rights do not come cheap for podding. You know, I think one of these days things will happen, and of course there's a lot of I guess they're calling it sort of open source music, but what it is music available through Creative Commons and things like that, that will make it possible. Why do I blather on this? Well, not only is Jarm Armstrong a really fascinating, wonderful, unique writer of speculative fiction, but, thank you, Tony, but he is also a man. Just walked out of here with my record. I say thank you. But you see, he's going to be enabling the show. We'll explain. But John Armstrong does a fascinating, fun, entertaining podcast as well. So these will be among the topics. And John and I, we haven't even really talked about our format for the program this morning, have we?
No, that's right. We started several times. Hello, everyone. I'm John Armstrong.
Yeah, but you see, and I be Jim Freund, but I never let anybody get a word in edgewise. And the problem is that John, for those attentive listeners who listen to when I promote events in other places, John was one of the two readers tonight with Beth Bernabeck at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, which is, well, gee, just as good as the reading series I produce, the New York Review of Science Fiction Series, where we had Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. But we had John first. We had John reading from Yarn. Was it June?
June or July, yeah.
Yeah, June or, no, July was Paolo Bacigalupi and Saladin Ahmed. So then you were June, yeah. And you read with...
Oh, I can see his face. I don't.
Was it Toby Bacall? Tobias Bacall?
I'm blanking at the name. It was funny.
And what? No, it was Greg Frost.
Yes.
It was Greg Frost, who's reading at KGB next month. And Greg Frost is always wonderful. Yeah. Oh, he was hilarious. That was a great piece. Mm-hmm. So John performed earlier tonight and had the choice of... Gee, am I going to have to do this 2 weeks in a row, or are we going to make this like one marathon session?
And I chose the marathon.
And you chose the marathon. Although what we are doing, and right now Tony Short is trying to enable us to be able to play, to turn back the clock and play the reading from earlier this evening so that John can just talk and not have to perform twice. Ah. Oh, yeah, great. Do a great radio effect, then hit the microphone, Freund. Somebody would think that you haven't been doing this for 40-plus years. That's just, I haven't been very good at it. Anyway, so that is part of what is going on. So let me just say that if you knew anything about science fiction or whatever, and you heard that somebody came out with a science fiction novel called Gray, you would probably expect the cover to have, a round-shaped sort of Casper the Friendly Ghost kind of alien of Whitley Strieber's thinking, the man who wrote Communion and who coined the term gray, of course. And not about fashion.
So you're saying the marketing was all wrong?
No, I'm saying, well, only insofar as if somebody just went by the title rather than the fab book cover, they would not, they'd get the wrong idea. Or maybe they'd get, the wrong idea. Well, they'd encounter the book perhaps for the wrong reason because, of course, that kind of communion... skiffy kind of stuff is really compelling to a lot of people. But the title refers to...
color. Actually, the title refers specifically to my experiences in 1984 in Japan. I got a lot, just like in one moment. I was in Japan as my junior year abroad. And had not packed very well. Japan was colder. They don't have central heating, so it was like you never warmed up. So my flimsy little jacket was just not enough, and I went out and I had to shop, God forbid. And there were not a lot of men's stores that had clothes that fit me or that I was any bit interested in until I turned the corner and came upon by complete accident, a store that had nothing but black, white, and gray clothes. And I knew I could match this stuff. I bought a black coat, which was kind of a fuzzy, furry thing. It was a long coat, which was kind of the style at that time in Japan. And I bought the coat. It kept me warm. I went back to the store and got to know the owner, whose name was Sugimoto-san. And that's where, in fact, one of the characters gets his name, because Sugimoto means roots of the cedar tree. So the main character in yarn, is his name is Tain Cedar, which is a direct kind of influence there. But in Gray, he was the tailor to the rich.
And kind almost of not, a cameo.
Yeah, he's really not in it very much at all. I always liked him. I wanted to give him more scenes, but it just, you know, they hit the cutting room floor. So after Gray came out, I wanted to go and write a little bit more about this Mr. Sugimoto, and that's where yarn comes from. Did I answer the question of Gray?
Yes. But well, not completely. It's still a little enigmatic exactly how it fits in.
So I got the idea of a world.
Isn't there also, by the way, some kind of apocalypse that's caused by nanobots called the gray event? I think there actually is.
In my book?
No. Oh. No, in the world.
Oh, I thought you were talking about. I don't think.
No,
I wrote
no,
that
no.
Chapter.
This is. Some people think this is nonfiction.
Oh, I see.
This is the idea that if a particular kind of nanotechnology were developed, that could be self-replicating and all that, it would basically never stop until the entire world was gray.
I see.
And I think that there are those people that believe this particular. Bunk.
So, maybe I'll write another book with the same exact title, but completely different.
There you go.
I like that. Anyway.
The other one you could do is Gray Advertising, but that's a whole other.
That's another. Well, I like advertising. And there's a good bit of advertising stuff in my work.
Yeah, but does Gray Advertising still exist? They used to be one of the big four.
I'm sure they were bought out by someone else.
They were huge.
Yeah.
But, you know, Doubleday was huge, and now it's a cubicle in somebody's office, just about.
I guess I was going to say one other thing about Gray. I already had started a story back in college, and I went back to that story and incorporated what I'd learned in Japan about the clothing and the culture and so on. But what I'd had before was a conflict between a father and son. And I used that conflict and was thinking about my own life with my folks and the kind of conflicts you see between the parents like a certain kind of music and the children like something else more loud and god-awful than their parents just to annoy them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually...
Unless somebody's father actually has a band.
Right. And in my case, my father was a musician. He was a jazz musician. And so I grew up in a house filled with music. My mom played classical guitar. My dad was a jazz pianist and later a keyboardist. So we had Moog synthesizers.
Ooh.
You know, almost the day they came out. I remember making 747 landing sounds in the living room. That was fun. And my brother also played. He was a percussionist. And my revolt against all of them was not to like music. I didn't have a radio. I didn't own an album until senior year of high school. I never listened to anything. I mean, I remember someone...
I didn't listen to what anybody else did. I listened to folky stuff, or they're listening to rock and roll. But I had my brother's turntable and his room to go to and listen to music. But.
No turntable, no radio, nothing. Most of the time, even if I'd had it, I'm sure this is a memory somewhat distorted, but it seems like I doubt I would have been able to hear it. I remember sometimes when my dad would have people over and there'd be a horn player and a bassist and him on keyboards. There was you couldn't go anywhere and in the house and not be blasted. It was loud. So thinking about that, I kind of stole that structure and gave the dad in Gray the most god-awful, heavy metal-esque, futurological, every vowel umlauted, a couple of times. And the worst possible fashions of platform shoes and plaid pants and a feather boa and giant sunglasses.
The nightmare of the 80s.
And so what would that child's dad do? And I thought he would go beyond what my rebellion was of just not having a radio. He would listen to one ton of feathers dropped on a grand piano. And in revolt of his...
Oh, John Cage. No, sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And a rebellion to
cheap
his...
shot at John Cage.
But I was adding a silent bump.
Okay.
The dad dresses in the most god-awful putrid colors, so the son dresses only in gray. So it was just a taking a little bit of what I'd experienced growing up and trying to push it as far as it would go. I was talking, actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Douglas Lane, the
yes.
writer? Okay.
Yes, he's been on the show.
Oh.
Years ago.
Oh.
And who is it who I had on the show not long ago who...
Talked about him?
Talked about him and worked with him. And she read at KGB early this year. And I'm blanking on her name. She came out with a manner punk type of...
Mary Robinette?
No, not Mary.
Oh.
Not Mary. No, that's another... another manner punk novel, Land of Milk and Honey,
right.
by Mary Robinette Kowal, K-O-W-A-L, for those of you going to look up right now.
Who I have a little cut from my podcast.
Yes.
We will maybe get to that later.
Yes.
When
it's
we finally,
all queued up, by
when
the way.
We finally discuss the format of our show tonight.
Yeah, which is already, like, we're already a third of the way. Well, not quite, but we're already past a fifth of it. And if you could pass the fifth, no, that would be illegal on the radio. But
what was I saying?
You were talking about Douglas
Lane.
Oh,
Douglas Lane, right. I was on
L-A-I-N, by the way, for listeners out there.
And he has a very interesting podcast, covers not just science fiction, but politics and philosophy, called the Diet Soap Podcast. And I was just, we recently recorded.
Check that out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He actually, I'm jealous in a way. He has stayed on a weekly schedule, and he has segments and sound collages, which are great, that he does often.
Uh-huh.
So he has like a real show, and his wife does a tidbit about a Titanic factoid at the end.
N.K. Hobson. Mary Hobson.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, that's she works with him a lot, and that's who was talking about him.
My point about my conversation with Douglas Lane was that he was talking about my work, and it's funny. I think I'm a fairly unconscious writer, and so that in a way, when I finish something, I deal with the themes, the people and the scenes and so on. But I in a funny way, I sometimes think I don't focus on some of the larger themes. Like someone was talking about the book, the Publishers Weekly was saying, with such social commentary. And that's not my focus when I'm writing it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else was asking, did you write a dystopia? And I said, I don't know. That's not what I didn't aim for that. That was not my goal. My goal was to try and tell the story and explore who these people are as best I can.
But you also do a lot of world building. And that's why I think people are, and I don't know, that may not be your focus, but it is something that you have accomplished in the creation of these books.
Yeah. I just heard from my agent that another agent at her agency.
Hi to Ginger.
Yes, hello, Ginger Clark. Someone else from the literary side of her agency was starting to read Yarn and said, wow, this is really good, and what an interesting world he's building. I think if I've done a good job, I've built a world in which different people can find different things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like the real world. That's my goal.
Yeah.
What people find in it, may differ from what I find
right
interesting in it. And that, I think, is, that to me means I did a good job. Because if I go in and look for purples and someone else comes in and says, wow, that's green, I've done it. Because
exactly.
All the... I've made,
but this is also like the if he'll allow, you know, the science fiction or speculative fiction of, say, Michael Chabon. The same kind of a thing where you can see where you can imagine the other stories that he hasn't written, but he has provided the setting. He has provided that world in which, you know, you can write your own story in his world, or your imagination will certainly do that and run free. And I certainly found that true of Gray.
Well, thank you.
And I haven't read Yarn all the way through, I'm sorry to say, although I've heard you read from it twice now. And but it's there. It's totally there. The idea that I can dwell in it after I have read the book. And, you know, I'm not saying that people should now start writing their own flash fic.
Right.
Or not flash fic.
Fanfic.
Fanfic. Thank you. Fanfic based on this universe. Although that would be rather curious.
I will probably end up doing that myself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would be great. Just get a whole bunch of see-through pseudonyms.
There's actually a scene in Yarn where the protagonist... He's taking a trip to find something. And at one point, he stops off basically for lunch. And he goes to... I was trying to think... I'd had an experience. I'd gone to a Chili's, one of those kind of mm-hmm. places. And it just... I was on the other side of a glass. I think we'd gone there just to so that my daughter could go to the bathroom. So I had like... I was waiting for 5 minutes in the alcove. So there's a glass separating me from the actual dining room. And I just felt like I am at an exhibit of some alien race and culture that I understand it, but it is so strange watching the waiters rush back and forth. And there was this party of teenagers, which made it funny because there are 20 of them all around the table, all texting who knows what. I mean, may not be each other or anything. And I just felt like... This is another world.
Yeah.
And so in the book, I don't really go into the texting kind of thing, but I did explore this idea of what would a restaurant that was maybe 5 city blocks long, where you would go to the restaurant and not leave for days, maybe. It mm-hmm. would just be one gastro, you know, experience.
Event after another. Yeah.
And with Dayglo burgers and individually cooked artesian French fries, multitudes of tiny little dipping sauces. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting...
Yeah, it's too long since we've eaten, so...
Sorry. But
I got a horrible buttered roll in my bag somewhere.
What I was thinking...
Even the guy selling it said, oh, this is hard, you know. Sorry.
My point was, I felt like I wanted to go back and explore that bizarre restaurant. Mm-hmm. Like, set a whole story there. I told Douglas on his podcast, what if a murder happened there and we followed one of the lowly, you know, French fry cooks who was maybe somewhat suspected? I just felt like yeah. There's a lot more to do there.
There really is. Yeah. There really is. I'm thinking that, you know, what would be really, really, really bizarre to take that exact concept that you just said. Make that an immersive video game. Right? Think about that. That actually has possibilities.
Yeah, I can see it a little bit, yes.
You know, sort of like, I don't know if you're familiar with, I think I told you once about one of my favorite pieces of software ever was for the Mac only called Cosmic Osmo. The same people had put out a PC version that was a shadow called Manhole. It started with a rabbit jumping down a manhole and you went in. There's no goal to the game. It was just an immersive universe. Cosmic Osmo was the ultimate. The same people who did that went on and found success with Myst.
Okay, I know Myst.
Yeah, many people do. But Cosmic Osmo is the preceding piece of software they put out. And even though it was only, you know, monochrome vector graphics for the old original one and only Macintosh, it was incredible. It was just an amazing, amazing experience. I worked for an interface design group that did everything from ATMs or whatever. And the and it was mandatory. This is actually a division of a major bank. It was mandatory for everybody in that division of that bank to play Cosmic Osmo, because it told you about how people think, what how people think. It was just wonderful. And the environments were that you would enter a museum for no particular. In one place, you go into a garage and you see a band. And you can play the instruments. Later on, you're in an elevator, and the music that you made in that garage is the Muzak in the elevator. Another point, there's a little paint set, and you can paint your heart's content. People spend hours and hours and hours creating paintings in this nice little alternate Mac-styled paint thing. Later on another part of the world, you'll find a museum, and your paintings are on exhibit in that museum. There's no goal. This is just that ingenious world. Now, people can create worlds like that. And those that can create fictional, interactive fiction stories. A good example of one, Amnesia by Thomas M. Dish, which was put out by, I think, Random House Software. Or it was, Harper. It was Harper and Row Software. It was that old. They probably put out two titles in the entire existence of the imprint. Mm-hmm. And it was great. So I'm betting that you could take that concept and make it an immersive game or environment,
right?
With a story.
Well, I can license the ideas for.
Yeah, and then of course you get celebrity chefs to do some of the voices.
I've already thought about how could I make some of the food. You know, what food colorings would you need? Because I was imagining that the burger would have like a swirl pattern of like a what's that, spiral paint? What was that, spin art?
Oh, yes. Now, the spiral graph.
Right.
And there was spin art where you just, you know, like held mustard like bottles over the thing, and that was spin art.
Right.
Oh, God, did I make a mess with that? I loved it.
Right.
So let's see. Mr. Ryan has returned with possibly. It looks like we're getting your reading from earlier tonight up on this machine.
Yes.
Excellent. How did you do that? And did I lose? Nope. There it is. The clown's nose on the end of my recorder. There, I'm always losing that thing. That's a replacement. I actually got it in a magic shop. That's a clown's nose. Everybody listening to their radio, take note that I bought a clown's nose. Thank you. Excellent.
Hope it works.
Yeah. So at some point, what we will do is, as we're listening to one of your pods, we will get the reading.
Okay.
We will cue up the reading so we don't hear all of the introduction. We'll just get right into the bing of it.
Let me know.
Okay. We haven't talked. We talked about the universe of Gray and Yarn and all that. But tell us a little bit more about Yarn and Mr. Cedar. And the premise. I mean, one thing is that obviously we're talking about fabulous and fantastic in the literal sense of the word. Immersive universe. Why do we, you and I at least, call this science fiction or speculative fiction? What do you call it, by the way? A book.
Yeah.
But you've been doing it within the science fiction community.
Yeah.
And that's a place where you dwell.
Well, yes. I wrote for years. Gray was a product of 20 or 25 years, but I would work on it and then go off and do, and I have a drawer or hard disk full of more mainstream kind of things. And I guess I I was concerned about... I loved writing Gray. It was just like the fun.
It reads like it was fun.
I probably have too much fun. I sometimes will be giggling at my own stuff and thinking, is this really the way I should be doing this? Is this right? But it is a lot of fun. But I guess I felt like maybe it just wasn't serious enough, as you know, we've so often been conditioned to think. So I wasn't comfortable with that in that way. So I spent a long time trying to produce something a little bit more serious, and none of that ever worked. So I was presented with an opportunity to present this to an agent a couple of years ago, and she loved it, and I haven't turned back. In the beginning, I thought, well, you know, I'll try this for a book or two, and I'll get back to the lofty ideas. But I'm just having too much fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'm working now on the third, and it's crazy, and I love, you know, each book goes back in time 20 years, and we follow one of the characters. The first book, Gray, kind of follows the nobleman of the time, the biggest celebrity of this world, is the main character. In Yarn, we get to find someone who's a little bit more in the middle, someone who's worked his way up through the society. And in the last one, it looks like we're going to follow the most hated and vilified criminal, sect or group. So we've gone through each of the three, you know, main strata throughout these three books.
And is that the last one? Have you determined that?
Well, I mean, this hamburger restaurant, which, by the way, in the book, in Yarn, it's called Melancholy Mouse Burger, is the name of the restaurant. I don't quite know what that means. I guess it's a little bit of a play on the Disney burger kind of place, but a sad, you know, there's that.
Yeah, I would think. I mean, nobody can be totally happy eating a mouse burger.
Right. There's something.
There'll be melancholy. Yes.
Right. Right. It's not depressive, but certainly a little bit of a downer.
Yeah. And I'm not sure about the nutritional value of it either, by the way, I must say.
Oh, it's real food.
Getting those. Yeah, but it's all those little bones, and are they ground up? What percentage is bones? That's what I've got to worry about.
Well, there are some people who worry. There are others who just go and enjoy.
Ooh.
I don't know where it will end. I certainly have some other ideas for other books going forward, but until you sit down and start writing and the story starts developing or the characters start coming alive, all the speculation and all the good ideas are nothing. I mean, writing the book, of fleshing it out, that's when it becomes something. And until that time, I mean, I can have the most wonderful, brilliant, genius idea. It means nothing at all. And you have to be wary of those great ideas. I mean, just like I had so many things I wanted to put into Yarn that I just cut out or never even could write. They just never fit. I mean, all the really great ideas are not in there, you know. So that's what makes it a whole world.
Well, let me ask you about these little, and what is it that a tailor calls little, you know, snippets that are
right.
Remnants. So all these little yarn remnants.
I'll tell you one that I never even wrote that I was just desperate to write about. I was speculating about what would a future grocery store be like. And here's what I thought. Let's go down the toothpaste aisle where there are demo babes trying to sell you on each and every brand of toothpaste, who are trying to engage you. I don't know if you know what a bar in Japan is like for most businessmen. In Japan, businessmen, it's like a little tribe. They will go out in pairs of threes and fours from their company. They'll go to a bar, and there will be girls there to talk to who are being paid by the bar. It's not a sexual thing. It's mm-hmm. just to have company. They will be charming. I mean, it's the modern day geisha, really. She will be smartly dressed. She'll laugh at your jokes. She'll keep pouring your beer or your whiskey and water. And I was just imagining a store where you don't walk in and see blinking lights or coupons or signs for sale. You would be accosted with hundreds of different strange and bizarre and, you know, slightly even erotic stories about toothpaste and why, you know, why she loves you and why this is the right thing. The marketing would be so tuned and so loud and so personal and so jarring that what if the future were like that? I mean, who was it who said advertising is just here because I can't go out and talk to you in person? And so maybe in the future there'll be so many people that we will be sending someone to talk to you about every brand.
And of course, in the Philip K. Dick universe, you have these little buzzing gnats that follow you around and advertise at you. And of course, and you know, this was, I mean, I wonder what Phil Dick would have made of Google. They know all about you. They could, you know, they could say, well, you made that purchase yesterday. Unhappy about that, aren't you? Why don't you? Yeah. And they just follow you until you pay them off.
So that was a scene that I could never even write. I mean, no character went into a grocery store. It didn't even get written to cut. But I've still cherished that idea. I think there's something there, but it wasn't part of the novel.
Well, part of my chauvinism and what I like to read, and one of my questions about these, you know, wonderful little, you know, parts that could have been, maybe one day will be, or whatever, is you don't tend to write short stories. And to me, these wonderful little remnants sound like short stories. And I love short stories, which is why I'm politicking here.
I think you have a good idea. I mean, I haven't thought of that, frankly.
You have a collection.
Yeah.
My work here is done.
I tend not to read very many short stories. It's a form I don't think about. I mean, I haven't written a short story since sometime in college or a short story workshop, I think is probably the last time, because I went from short stories to screenplays, decided I would never.
And that's a particular length. That's a particular form.
Right. And so I thought, okay, no one will ever want to make these totally bizarre screenplays. So I then jumped to the novel, thinking I'm then in charge again. It's my production. I get to hire as many naked women as I want for my book.
There you go.
And I never looked back, and I haven't looked back, and I haven't read many short stories. And so it's just a form I don't feel comfortable with.
Yet.
The idea that I can...
can people tell I'm pushing my guest on the air?
You know, I'm...
You'd be fabulous at it.
I can't argue with you there, yeah. But
no, I mean the very thing that we're talking about here is how you're saying things that didn't make it into the novel. Well, that's right. They are, but they're also complete little chapters, but incidents, pieces, parts of a larger montage that, you know, Rick Bowes would call mosaic novel or whatever, that all exist beautifully in that kind in this world. Now, I mean, the problem is short stories are just as difficult to write as novels, and you can get paid, you know, like, oh, maybe $70 for one if you're lucky. But on the other hand, they are a joy to partake of.
I haven't tried. Maybe I will.
Yeah.
I do. I think we were talking earlier, just real quick.
Yeah.
I do have every time I write a book, I have a file of all the stuff I've cut out, which is usually 4 or 5 times longer.
And I'm using the Taylor thing, so I keep thinking remnants.
Yeah.
Scraps drawer.
Maybe I've got 15 short stories already, if I just found them and cut them into the right length.
It could very well be.
Yeah.
That could very well be.
But that's an editing job, you know.
But it's also a conceptual job.
Yeah.
And, pardon me, knowing your universe and knowing where that goes, but yeah, that could very well be. Ask Ginger.
I'll inquire.
Ask your agent. Yeah. It's like, you know, ask your doctor. No, ask your agent. Would you like to, you know, we're almost, pardon me, amazingly almost halfway done with the show. You understand? It flies.
We haven't done anything.
Yeah, well, no, we've talked wonderfully. But right now, you know, we have like, what, 8 and a half minutes of little podcast snippets. But we also have half an hour of you reading from this book. And I'm thinking, and Tony went to a great deal of trouble to enable us to do that. So would this be a good opportunity?
Sure.
Okay, so let me tell you that first, you're listening to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and available at WBAI.org. If you are listening live, it is stream.WBAI.org, or if you are now listening in the future to the past, it is archive.WBAI.org. And my podcast doesn't exist yet, but it may end up on John's before it reaches mine. Whatever. This is WBAI. This is Hour of the Wolf. My guest this morning is, or night, is John Armstrong. And earlier this evening, John read, as I said, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series here in New York on 4th Street. And we're going to cut to the chase and get to chapter one of the novel Yarn.
So I'm going to read the first chapter and a couple pages into the second chapter, if I have time.
Okay, we're having a slight...
let me know if you can't hear me.
Okay. Yeah, no, we can hear you.
Suffocated by a
but we're having... A
sense of exactly the feeling of wool against...
Okay, I'm going to switch here to the player that Tony had originally set me up with. I was doing that on a WAV file. Never mind. We can now continue.
It's the skin on a warm day. Yet here in the dark of my bedroom, the sun seemed impossibly far away. What had set this fear in my veins? None of my current design projects were so difficult or important. I was using a new half-micron twill for a suit, but I had tested the fabric extensively and knew its properties. And although the motor-driven ball gown we were creating was complicated, my assistant and I had spent a whole day installing the mechanics and testing it again and again. No, those projects were essentially complete, and I felt good about their look, materials, and function. It was no use. Neither sleep nor an answer was forthcoming. I rose, wrapped in a swirling unease, and prepared for the day. It was still dark when I drove through the obsidian and gold towers of Ross Vegas to the studio. And as I walked the 200-meter metal and wood meditation and exhibition entry hallway that spiraled in from the building entrance to my showroom front door, I went over the fashion consultations I had scheduled for the day, the calls I needed to make to suppliers, the fabric tests I needed to run, and the gathering swarm of details of an upcoming show. In the hallway, I powered on the fashion exhibits that I had on display, including two fabric-bursting automatons and a pilling analysis machine, and stooped to collect a few dust fibers on the dark wood floor. At the end of the spiral, I paused at a display that held the yarn I'd gotten from my father. It rested on black velvet and was lit with a single heterojunction crystal, which bathed the thread with a warm, otherworldly glow, recalling the dawn when I'd pulled the strand from my father's pocket so many years ago. But my memories could not linger because someone or something was lurking beyond the next curve near the showroom doors. Peeking around the last swell of the wall, I saw a figure draped head to toe with dark fabric. The weave was a deep, dark charcoal green with a slight sheen like elf wax, a fiber I never used. While it wasn't completely unusual for someone to come unannounced, the hour and the dress were suspect. Tentatively, I stepped forward, waiting for the visitor to move or speak. At 10 feet away, I stopped, and as the milliseconds ticked by in silence, began to fear that this was some sort of an attack, that this laundry pile covered an assassin. But even as I cataloged the properties of my jacket, titled Waterhold 11, with both fluid dynamics and charged particle closures, and thought how I might use it to defend myself, my fear seemed misplaced and wrong. I wet my lips. The showroom is by appointment only. The head turned slightly. The voice that emerged was tatty and frail. I've lived a fool's life and will come to a fool's end, but I've come to ask you a favor. The skin on my neck and back puckered with goosebumps. Vada! The heels of my saline Audis clapped percussive notes on the polished wood. I never thought I'd see you again. Where have you been? What happened? What are you wearing? The outline of an arm came away from the torso and touched the door a moment later. After a small, moist click of what I imagined were her gaunt lips, she said, "I'm sorry. I'm dying." My throat tightened. "No." As though simple denial changed anything. She didn't reply. Where have you been? What happened? "I need help." "Of course," I said. "What happened? Are you in pain?" Without thinking, I reached my hand to hers. She shrank back, shaking her head. "I need your help." Anew, I saw the rough material that covered her in contrast to the faultless cut, fine texture, and precise stitching of my garments. Shame flooded me. "I never expected to see you again. I had my battles, my deceptions, and my gardens of failure." She spoke like it was her slogan. I gazed where I imagined were her eyes. "I tried to find you. I even hired a detective, but he found nothing. I wish I could see her face. 3 weeks ago, I was in Kong. You'd never believe it. But there's 50 chrome towers and solar plots there on that old muddy hill. It's completely different." The cloth shook as she nodded. "You look good, Tane. I'm sorry, but I can't stay. They're closing in." I wondered what she was running from this time. "You must be hungry. Allow me to at least feed you." Beneath the cloth, she straightened. "I need a Z-coat. Z yarn, old, immoral, and drug-infused yarn. That's not a cure." I gestured at the materials of the hallway as evidence of my wealth, the rare lumber, the hand-poured high-carbon concrete, and the custom-built fabric test machines. "What do you really need, Vada? Surgery? I can get satellite organs." Her head leaned forward. Wrinkles of the fabric covered her face. "There's just, no, I can't go on." Her words were so quiet I barely heard. "It's time. I need pure." She meant pure Z. The loving, the universal, the erotic, the dreaming Z, as opposed to the other kind. Dark Z. Scream Z. Nightmare Z. It occurred to me that she was wearing the basket weave not so much to hide from the authorities, but because she had been disfigured by torture. "Listen," I said, stooping to meet her hidden eyes. "Come in," and said, "whoever is after you, I'm sure we have a few moments." I reached for where I thought I would find her wrist or forearm, but bumped into what was probably her hip and pulled back. The pile of basket weave turned as if to leave. "Wait," I began. I guess I was looking for you because I've been thinking about you. The truth is, in some way, there's been no one else. I hope you haven't been waiting for me." "No." I felt small, although the truth was I had not. "I just mean that..." I stopped and chided myself for trying to explain. "Tane, I'm sorry. I understand." Her voice warmed. "I think of you, too. We had an incredible affair." She'd overstated it. "We had 8 months," I corrected her. 240 outfits and costumes in about as many days. I tried to keep my tone light, but felt its strain. You know who I am. I nodded and smiled politely. It was always about who she was. In the stillness of the hallway, I could hear her swallow. I've heard about you and your work. I'm proud of you. You've made wonderful things. She seemed to laugh for an instant, but then I thought I heard a tiny, clenched grunt. She was still for long, and then she finally inhaled a convex of the fabric forming over her mouth. I stepped toward her, fearing she might collapse, but she backed away. Can you make me a Z-coat, please? She exhaled a ragged breath. I just want to die without pain. I had absolutely no idea where or how I would get the Z-yarn. I'll do it. I'll come back tomorrow night. Tomorrow, I laughed. Wait, Vada, first of all, I don't think the yarn is still even made. I would have to find someone who somehow still has some, get it here, weave it into cloth, and then make a jacket. I waited for her reply, but none came. Whispering, I said, tomorrow is impossible. You're very talented, she said, and turned away. Wait. Irrationally, I was struck with a terror that I might never see her again, and even as I tried to choke the words in my mouth, I asked, did you ever really love me? Her body slumped, fabric pooling at her feet. I'm sorry, Vada. I felt ashamed. I was unraveling before her. It's just that I've been thinking about what happened, mulling it over, and I'm sorry. It's just a shock that you're here. Tane, she said very quietly. I must go. Please, I need the coat tomorrow. Vada, tomorrow is impossible. I'll try my best, but it will take days. Even as I spoke, the rounded top of the cloth relaxed like a balloon beneath was losing air. Wrinkles and valleys appeared as the pile descended to the floor. She was collapsing before my eyes. Reaching into the fabric to grasp her, I found nothing but more wrinkles of the basket weave. I flung the fabric to the side, afraid I was going to uncover a puddle of flesh. I found nothing. Dropping to my knees, I pushed aside the cloth and felt the cool floorboards beneath. I turned my gaze to the showroom doors and down the curve of the hallway. The place was empty and silent. It was as if I'd been visited by a ghost. Studying the floor where she had been standing, I discovered that one of the hardwood planks had been disturbed. The clear diamond coat sealer neatly sliced along its lines. Yet as hard as I banged on it, I could not make it move. Vada, where are you? Slumping to the floor, I heard the rhythm of my breathing, the air molecules being sucked into and pushed out of my bronchi. I heard the rush of the blood in my ears and the distant clap of my heart valve. She wasn't the fool I was for believing and cherishing the impossible. Picking up the basket weave, I held it to my nose and inhaled. I smelled a mixture of rose, corn, and a hint of smoke.
And there was, sadly, a hint of smoke at the KGB bar tonight, where you just heard from the KGB bar this. By now it's Thursday morning, but that was Wednesday night. John Armstrong reading from his novel Yarn. And by the way, we need to mention that the portal for the podcast, for information about the books and all that, are at johnarmstrong.com. There's no H in Armstrong, nor is there one in John. It's JONARMSTRONG.
Correct.
And this show, by the way, is HOURWOLF.com, Our Wolf, or Our of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is WBAI New York. And in case you couldn't figure out from what I was saying, our guest is John Armstrong. That's a wonderful, this is what I was talking about before, all these wonderful little worlds and things in there. Even if you haven't read the first book, I don't think you really need to be that familiar. it's much better if you know gray. And as I said, I haven't read yarn through, but I've gotten pieces of it. And did you think of it as a potential standalone?
Yeah. In fact, you absolutely don't have to read gray to get this one. There's nothing plot, theme. They're just related, really.
Yeah.
The one character appears in character from Gray is now the main character of Yarn. But other than that, there's absolutely no carryover in plot or anything.
Yeah. So
my agent is often quick to point out standalone, which
yeah.
Now I'm using in my third book as what they call books. I just love that it's a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
What are you reading? A standalone, you know.
As opposed to a stand apart,
right.
Which is a whole other different concept.
That's a different genre.
Yeah. What I'd like to do is open up the show on two fronts, as it were, at the same time. One is to listen to one of your podcasts, but also to offer people to call in. And the rules on Hour of the Wolf, for those who are unfamiliar, now that this is our new time. Oh, yeah. I have to mention, by the way, that Laura Ann Gilman is our guest next week. So tune in next week at this time to have missed the first hour of the show, or better yet, tune in at 1:30 for Laura Ann Gilman. And I'll start with Robert Knight at midnight and just stay tuned all night. And don't forget, Lister is coming up with Burn Baby Burn Clappers at 3 a.m. Just an amazing reggae show. Just, I mean, it's fabulous stuff. He's almost late. He's always setting up outside the room here by now. So if you would like, the rules, as I was saying, for calling up on Hour of the Wolf at 212-209-2900 are relevance. Not relevance to the world, not relevance to what's happening, man, but relevance to what we've been discussing, which is the fiction of John Armstrong this morning. That's relevance for you. And the podcast and other things that we've been discussing, including to an extent, the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction. But, you know, in other words, I am the arbiter. I am the Omega. No, I am the arbiter. And it's like, you know, if I start hearing about, well, freedom of speech or whatever, you will find, no, there isn't. I cut people off. I'm nice about it. You know, it's I just ask you, the listeners, to be nice to us. So that's 212-209-2900. And so which we have eight snippets. We don't have time for eight snippets from your podcast. And every one, I don't know which I would choose because they're all fabulous.
I have a couple. This is a podcast that I do nearly biweekly. It's called If You're Just Joining Us, and it's at ifyourejustjoiningus.com. You can just type in If You're Just Joining Us and John Armstrong into Google, and I'm sure it will come up. It's also on iTunes. It's a podcast for pods. Why don't we start with number four? Let me just preface this by saying I did a podcast with the editor of Yarn. I was halfway into her edits. You know, I got a pile of papers from her, the manuscript with all of her marks. I started working on it. And halfway into it, I spoke to her on the phone, and this is the beginning of the podcast. I'm excited and also a little fearful of this podcast.
You're fearful. Interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm in the middle of editing my novel Yarn based on your edits. And there have been, I mean, this has been, for me, it's been, I want to say up and down. It's been mostly up and then down and then down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds pretty difficult.
Have you heard from other writers, I mean, about what they go through in editing?
Yeah. A lot of times, I usually only hear from them after they've gone through the initial horrified mourning phase and they're excited And so then they contact me and say, oh, I'm so excited. And he said, it's great. And it's wonderful. And I'm getting all this great work done. And then in the middle, they will often go through these periods of, you know, extreme self-doubt and horror. And I might sometimes get missives at that point as well.
I don't recognize that at all. So
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, it's very strange. Yeah, well, I am I mean, I just passed halfway, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, yeah, I'm starting to come out of the deep, deep depression.
Okay, and you see, I'm so interested in just talking here that we actually slipped into the next podcast there, and I was greeting Lister, who was just coming in to do...
So that was Juliet Ullman, who...
One of the important people in the field.
Yeah, she is actually now the acquiring editor at Pugilist Press, which is an imprint from Nightshade, my publisher.
It's a brand new imprint.
Yeah, I think their first book will appear next year sometime.
I think so, yeah. I mean, they only announced it like over the summer.
Right, right. It was just after we finished the edit that that it was actually announced. I remember the tweet. And I was pretty excited for her. She was wonderful. And we got to talk about...
Where was she before Nightshade? Because she's been... Nightshade is a relatively new press,
right.
You know, mere 15 years old or something like that. And Juliet Ullman has been around for, well, longer.
Yes. And I'm not remembering
okay,
the house.
So, yeah.
But so we talked...
If I can ever get her on this show, I'll ask her.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
she was a lot of fun, and it was interesting to hear because that was, you know, I've had two books, so that was my second time of really getting an editorial, not just a letter, but she went through it, you know, line by line, and I fortunately didn't see the red ink that she prefers to use. I might have had a reaction going back to sixth grade and Mrs. Jones, because I later saw it in red, and it was a little, it was jarring.
Yeah, I would think blue pencil was more of the editorial.
She liked, it's a teacher.
She likes red ink.
She has a specific color of ink. The other thing that we talked about, there were a couple things that we talked about were of interest, but she...
She's a Vermilion editor.
Yeah. Looking at her comments through the book, I kind of got a sense of what she was thinking and feeling. And we talked a little bit about that. And it was true because sometimes you would see that she'd scribbled and her, you know, the tenor of her handwriting changed as I was making like some little word choice that she'd seen five times and was now annoyed at. So it was fun to talk about what was otherwise just barely evident in the manuscript at that point. Another clip we might play is number 7. This is a guy, his name is Paul Goat Allen. He's a book reviewer. In a way, a claim to fame is he's done more than 6,000 book reviews over the last 20 or so years.
Where do these appear?
He's published his reviews for the Chicago Inquirer, a Publisher's Weekly, and he now does stuff on the Barnes & Noble website. He has a blog called Explorations of Science Fiction and Fantasy. If you Google Paul Goat Allen, you will find him.
And how would you spell that?
Just as it sounds. Goat as in...
G-O-A-T?
Wow. G-O-A-T. Okay. Yeah, and on the podcast, I ask him, was my first question, where did the goat come from? We have a little snippet of him talking about what it is to review books for him.
I love books that aren't conventional, that aren't formulaic. If you look at books through my eyes and reading all of this stuff that is just rehashing older novels or just completely derivative, just completely just uninspired schlock. I mean, there's so much stuff out there that is just mediocre. It's just mediocre. And when I read something that is like truly original or just, you know, really, really well written, It just, I think it affects me more. That's why I just love this job, because I can, you know, discover these books that I think a lot of readers would never find. And then if I can kind of show it to them and say, hey, read this book. I just think that's such a great feeling.
Okay, a little bossa nova here for...
I found Paul Goat Allen years ago because he clearly really enjoyed Gray. And I kept Googling his name, or occasionally I would just Google me, actually, what it
was. Well, yeah.
And he would
a come vanity up. Google, yes.
Right, right. Ego search.
Yeah, I call them vanity searches, yeah.
And so he came up a couple more times as was mentioning Gray as being almost earth-shattering and life-changing. And I kept thinking, who is this guy? I mean, I like my book.
Yeah.
But it was like, I think he likes it better than I do. I mean, could that be? So I finally tracked him down and we talked about it. And he...
I mean, if he's that well read and reviewed, he must be familiar with SF.
Oh, he does SF and fantasy.
But you see, that's the thing, is that the Gray and Yarn... Yes.
The big sigh.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the big sigh, as opposed to the big sci-fi. Because what are they, you know, in among the best of books? You don't want to define them. You know, people say, what is science fiction versus what is fantasy, blah, 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 and they pigeonhole. Well, I was thinking about it because last night as Ellen Kushner was reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. She's reading one of her Riverside stories that started with the Swords Point and all that, which I think sort of coined the concept of manor punk. And what is fantasy? Well, nothing. I mean, yeah, and all of it. It's a universe that doesn't exactly exist, but the people are all extremely credible. The world is a completely built world. There is no magic. There are no supernatural events. There's no science. There's no rocket cars or anything whizzing. In fact, there's not that much technology in the Riverside novels. Now let's talk about Gray and Yarn. And behind you, though, by the way, those are called fantasy, sometimes urban fantasy. Now, what is Yarn? Well, most people would call it science fiction or speculative fiction as opposed to fantasy. What makes it science fiction? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's no more science fiction than Riverside is fantasy, I think.
I don't disagree, yeah. And I don't worry about that. I know it is sometimes difficult for some readers who are looking for certain things. I mean, I've seen reviews from readers.
Not enough elves for fantasy and not enough...
No elves.
Yeah, right.
But also not enough hard sci-fi. I mean, I've seen people complain this isn't real science fiction. And it may not be.
But you see, of course it is.
Yeah.
But how do they define real science? And if they do define it that way as real science fiction, then I don't do a real science fiction radio show. And half of the science fiction writers out there don't. Way more than half.
Right.
Of the science fiction writers out there don't write real science fiction. Rick Bowes. There are technologies. There are sometimes ghostly events. What is here? I call it speculative fiction, which is a term, by the way. I love to point this out to people. They think, oh, that's a new touchy-feely term, right? Coined by Robert Anson Heinlein in 1946, speculative fiction. So don't, you know, and he was, you know, people think of him as one of the great science fiction writers.
I think that term probably more encompasses what I do than science fiction in some way. But
it's genre.
Yeah.
Clearly. I mean, it belongs to the genre. And why? My answer to that is because people who like reading A, B, and C will also like reading this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you throw a lasso around it and you say, oh, yeah, people are going to like all of these together, and therefore, if you like those, then you will like this, and it exists within genre.
But I don't mind mixing things, and even irreverently. I mean, I do the same on my podcast. I don't just... the majority of the interviews are with other authors in science fiction and fantasy kind of realms. But I've also interviewed a men's fashion designer. I interviewed a cook who schooled at MIT. He writes on a food blog, and he was doing an experiment that day answering the age-old question, when you're cooking a burger, should you flip it once or multiple times? And so he set up... He set up an experiment in his house and made lots and lots of burgers and timed it, you know, cooked them all the same weight.
3 minutes one side, 3 minutes right. the other, and with the cheese on after the 3 minutes, yes.
And then he did another one where he flipped
on an
it.
Iron skillet only.
Yep. He controlled all the factors. I mean, he really does it in a scientific way, and the results are quite surprising.
Yeah, so, well, what are the results? You have to tell me. It was once, wasn't it?
No, flipping. Multiple times.
Oh. It
actually, he ended up not on the day I recorded.
Listener, is this supposed to be for me, this zero here? Well, thank you. He's given me zero. Thank you. I'm going to try this, yes.
He actually came up with a slightly different technique later that he wrote about on his blog, where he... cook the burgers in a low temperature oven to get the middle to the right temperature, and then very high heat seared the outsides, but flipped it several times.
Very interesting. Then now is he using a cast iron?
He was using a high carbon pan, very low
edges. That might be part of what makes the difference, because I'm doing it on cast iron.
Yeah, I think this...
And I like that crust. You
know? He was into the crust too.
Huh.
And he felt like this could retain higher heat. He's a real cook too.
A cook from MIT. Yeah, well, that would be the real thing, I would think. Yeah.
And one other cut I thought we'd play if we have time.
Yeah.
I took some classes at at FIT, which is the Fashion Institute of Technology, back in the 90s. And I had a couple of wonderful, wonderful classes. Which
number is
this? This is number 8, sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Which I revisited here. This is a textile science professor talking about a question that he asks his class, and the question is, who is the greatest fashion designer of all time?
Levi Strauss, I consider to be the greatest fashion designer of all time, because I believe that his five-pocket 501 jeans was... patented or was developed by 1870, has been in continual production since. And if we measure success in terms of profit, then I maintain that nothing has even come close. But then the interesting thing, as far as students' response to this, is that I then follow it up and say, now look at, if you agree with me, that the five-pocket jean invented by Levi Strauss is the most successful design in history. Let's explore a little further. It's one fiber content, one fabric weight, one construction, one dye, and there are other ones in there, but it is the most plain vanilla, non-varied product that you possibly could cite. In other words, where fashion is usually predicated on change, quite the opposite occurs in this particular case. So that's my reason for it. And they, as a rule, they usually accept it. And then if they don't, I usually will follow back and say, then, well, every time we have a new fashion season, what you see in Bryant Park, what you see in the Minna magazines is one thing. But when you go to the stores, it seems that those very same names are making most of their money, putting most of their effort in their jeans. Jeans predominate. Jeans overwhelm. Jeans are unisex. You can wear jeans high and low. You can dress them up. You can dress them down. And it's pretty phenomenal when you really get right down to it.
Okay.
You know what I found so interesting about that class is, maybe this is true of a lot of things, is that the clothes we wear on our bodies, we know almost nothing about as average consumers. He was just talking about jeans. The fabric of jeans, denim.
Denim?
Denim. Well,
huh?
Be careful.
Cotton of Nîmes, is it not?
There's a town in France where there's a certain kind of fabric made, which is not what we kind of think of as denim. Levi Strauss really changed
the fabric. Okay.
And why did he change it? He went out to San Francisco with a canvas to make tents, but he found the miners there didn't need so many tents. They were having trouble with their pants falling apart for all of the hard work. So he started taking that canvas and making pants, but it was not the right material. So he went back and engineered a fabric to work. So you're familiar with jeans. If you remember the old-fashioned kind, which were very dark on the outside and white on the inside, that's a twill fabric. A twill is a kind of weave where one yarn, which is going in one direction, will be 50%, will be divided such that there's more yarns of one type on one side. The ones on the outside had a heavy indigo dye to make them very strong and rugged, but the ones on the inside had no dye, so they were much softer against the skin. Because the problem with his original fabric that he went out there with, it was tearing the miners' legs up as much as it was repelling the rocks and junk that they were digging through. So the jeans were a specific engineered product for a specific, engineering problem. Really blew my mind.
And yeah.
Now we wear them, we have nothing to do with all that, but it still stayed with us.
And half of what we call jeans and all that are not the cotton of Neem or anything.
Well, the cotton of Neem that name has stuck, but it actually is not the same fabric.
But it never had anything to do with it.
Had very little to do with it.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting, yeah.
And so
And I love etymology of not just words, but things, and this is a bit of both here.
Right, right. Yeah.
And, you scratch these stories and you find such wonderful things underneath.
I remember the final exam for that class. This was a class called Textile Science. And you were given maybe four or five swatches of fabric. And your job, you had a loop, which was a magnifying glass, much like you see a jeweler use.
Mm-hmm.
And what was called a pick, which was basically a sharp little instrument. And your job was to start taking these swatches of fabrics apart and write down as much as you could figure out, having gone through the class. What kind of yarn was being used? What kind of a weave was it? What might the applications be for this thing? To imagine that all sorts of fabrics were being engineered and specifically designed for specific problems and specific solutions just fascinated me. And that really informed my writing as I went back. I went back to gray and then later yarn and rewrote things and added things and filling in that kind of a world.
Yeah, and that's where we were talking about off the air, all of these, trunk stories.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're called so-called because people put them in their trunks and can later haul them out or whatever. So you have possibly an amazing trove to pull from. Again, can you tell I'm pressuring my guest?
To write some short stories.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. To create some short stories or novellas. And it makes it even more immersive as you get into that tale. And this is, by the way, something, I was comparing the craft of what you do to what Ellen Kushner does, because I had the joy, but tiring, of going to readings two nights in a row before doing this. And thinking about Ellen had these novels, the Sword Point books, and there are three novels in that series. But then she has The Swordsman, whose name was not Death, The Man with the Knives, this one that's in a forthcoming Ellen Datlow book, which is about urban city, about cities and Urbania and all that. It's that same universe. And you know what? After you've spent all this time immersed in this novel, and your mind is wandering and going through that place, if you find a short story after that, it brings the novel right back. It brings you back into that world. And not only is it world building, but it makes the world that much larger to see just another tiny little corner of it, even if briefly.
I'm not disagreeing.
I see that. Otherwise, I wouldn't keep going on. And also, I'm just extolling the virtues to the listeners of the short story in general, which is why I always recommend that people should pay attention when the various best of the year anthologies come out, whether it's science fiction or fantasy or both. They're usually great ways. Or you see one that's on a topic that you like. Those are always very popular. So Datlow is doing one just of teen vampires, which I think is, well, I mean, that's a market.
Mm-hmm.
That's one heck of a market, as a matter of fact. But I mean, yeah, there's everything from unicorns to rocket jockeys.
Right. I just need a couple other people writing about future fashions and future advertising. And
it's a good question. Who else has actually taken fashion and turned it into science fiction stories?
You see touches, I mean, here and there.
I just thought of one.
Yeah.
And it's something that nobody would ever think of as science fiction, but in fact is all about technology. It's a movie. And I'm blanking on the name. Alec Guinness. Not the man in the white coat? No, the
gray flannel suit?
No. That's Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
No. This is Alec Guinness invents a white material, pure white material. In fact, can't take color, sort of like, you know, Superman material. So nothing can happen to it, including dyeing it. So it's perfectly snow white, and it's indestructible.
Mm-hmm.
And, the man in the white suit, I think. And, if you think about it, it is, of course, it's about a non-existent technology. And there is, in fact, sort of a technological denouement of the story that, you know, the technology, something happens to it. And it's a technologically driven but human story.
Hmm. Did you say denouement?
Yeah, not intentionally. Denouement, yes, denouement. That's me jeans or something like that. Denouement.
I was going to say that in the podcast where I talked to Paul Goat Allen, he mentioned a Canadian writer, and I can't remember the guy's name, and quoted a little bit, and he said, that's Armstrong. And I... So there must be some. We'll have to gather some. I'll maybe come up with something, but
yeah,
I can't give you a time frame, Jim.
Yeah, but no, that would be a fabulous premise for an entire anthology, yeah, wouldn't it? Fashion, clothing.
I didn't realize I was going to come here and get an assignment from you.
Well, not so much an assignment as a thought, you know, just something. So let's see if I can. I don't really have the time to look up all of Alec Guinness's movies. Well, actually, yes, I do. The Man in the White Suit.
Okay.
1951. And that. So I was right about the title. It's not just a description, but it's the name of the movie.
Yeah.
And you should see it.
I will look it up.
Yeah, it's also just a great Alec Guinness comedy, and that always qualifies in my book. Well, we've got 90 seconds left. Is that amazing?
That is.
It's
been a pleasure to be on and speak with you, and we've hung out for most of the evening now, and it's always a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was tremendous fun. It's great stuff. The books at hand, as somebody used to say, are gray. That's G-R-E. No, A.
No,
E. No, it is E. Yeah. I was right the first time. I was never good about that. I was never good about that as a kid, and I still get it wrong. G-R-A-E-Y. G-R-E-Y. Oh, my God. I'm going to keep doing it. And the Y leads you right into yarn, gray and yarn. The author is John Armstrong. That's J-O-N Armstrong at johnarmstrong.com. And that can also be used as a portal to the podcast.
Correct.
Which is entitled...
If You're Just Joining Us.
Indeed. And we are not joining. We're actually departing now. 90 minutes. I mean, I always thought 2 hours went by quickly. But 90 minutes is an enjoyable, you know, like, bang, and it is done. So we will do this again, John.
It was great fun. I look forward.
Yeah, and maybe next night you can read a short story about it. well, you know. Anyhow, everybody listening, thank you for tuning in. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next Wednesday night, Thursday morning from 1:30 till 3 a.m. with Laura Ann Gilman, who deserves lots of thanks and praise for allowing us to adjust the schedule. Coming up, I don't know which week will be John Sprunk, who has something from Pyre Books. So, well, we're going to have interesting times ahead in this time slot. Stay tuned for Lister with Burn, Baby Burn, Clappers. Good morning. Out on the sea.
and you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org.
Mama said, son, I ain't got no food today. Tit for tat, butter for fish. There's a little porridge in the dish, Mama said. There's a hole in the roof. You've got to make it waterproof. Son, daddy left you from you a four. I've got to struggle cause I am poor. She said, food is a very hard thing to find. Sometimes I feel like I'm going out of my mind. Mama say, son, today look like a rainy day. But the food I ain't got enough. Rain or fall, but dirt is tough. Mama say, son, I ain't got no food today. Tit for tat. Butter for fish. Here's a little porridge in the dish. Daddy left you from you a four. Yeah. I've been struggling. I am poor. Oh, oh. To find food, yeah. It's so hard.
Bye.
at exactly 13 minutes after the hour right here on Burn Baby Burn Clappers Lister right here. Thank you very much, Jim Freund. And before that, that was Robert Knight, y'all. Don't forget the 5 o'clock shadow. Yeah, right here at Pacifica Radio at its very best. The brand new Pacifica Radio features Felipe Luciana, Por Favor Para Ti, on Friday. Wake up call. Esther comes in at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 6 to 8, with a brand new wake up call. Democracy Now, Democracy Now, Democracy Now. With Amy Goodman, more radical than ever, right here at WBAI. Ghost Horse on the case, right after Amy. It's a Thursday right here where your Friday begins, where your Saturday begins, where your Sabado begins, where militancy begins, right here at WBAI. Yeah. Going up to 15 minutes after 3 o'clock, you know who first played this in the USA? WSB out in Stony Brook, 90.1 FM, back in the days. Yeah, there's a big fight against reggae music in imperialist America. My music, you gotta smoke the hydroponic, nothing medical, y'all. Right here at Burn Baby Burn.
My music is so divine, it can make you feel a little.